Hello and welcome to Bangalore International Centre's very own podcast, BIC Talks. Bangalore International Centre is a platform for informed conversations, exchange of ideas, and a space for arts and culture. BIC Talks brings the essence of all that the physical space stands for and more to your doorstep.
What was the life like of one of Bangalore's last hunters? Donald Anderson was a colonial-era shikari, hunting tigers and panthers and more. Born in 1934 and passing away in 2014, Donald lived out of Bangalore and also witnessed the city and the world change over the 20th century, even as he perhaps stayed the same. Hi, I'm Pavan Srinath and welcome to BIC Talks. Joshua Matthew has written an excellent memoir of Don Anderson titled The Last White Hunter. The book is drawn from extensive conversations with Don during the last years of his life. He's in conversation today with author and literary critic Sheila Kumar. Hi Joshua and Sheila, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you both on the show.
Thanks, Pavan.
Thank you, Pavan.
And over to you, Sheila.
Hi Joshua.
Hello, Sheila.
Let me begin by saying I so enjoyed reading your book. The Last White Hunter, Reminiscences of a Colonial Shikari by Donald Anderson with Joshua Matthew, is what it says on the book's cover. However, my take on it as a professional book reviewer is that it is less a memoir and more your telling of the fascinating story of Donald Malcolm Stuart Anderson, a British-era hunter who lived in Bangalore some 60, 70 years ago. I've noticed that you've kept the narrative at a low pitch all through, allowing Don Anderson's fantastical story to come through loud and clear, and pretty much without filters. Was that deliberate, Joshua?
So I must start off by saying I've had no experience of writing anything before, not even a blog. But I just knew that this story had to be written in the first-person narrative, kind of like a memoir, as I felt that that style would hopefully immerse the reader a little better, make them feel the mirth, and even maybe the sadness and the gloom. But there were so many limitations, including Don's age, right? He was almost 75 or so when I started to write the book. So I really had to improvise and therefore wrote the first chapters as if Donald was narrating his life. And then the last chapter, what I would call as an extremely long epilogue from my perspective. So it is a different way of actually putting the book together. Now, regarding the filter, you're absolutely spot on. I did realize the risk of writing it in this style, right? Someone telling their story in almost an unapologetic way. A story of someone who lived a very self-centered life. You know, that may not be the best topic for a book. But what was important for me was to capture the story in the same manner he described them to me, Sheila. So if he was excited about a particular incident that, so during the narration, he would, you know, even enact it out with gesticulations and sound effects and things like that. And I attempted to use the same brush strokes while I put them on paper. If he was narrating a sad story or something that upset him, I tried to capture that emotion. So absolutely no filter between what he described it and the way I put it on paper.
Well, Joshua, I've got to say that you really pulled it off because it sure works.
Thank you.
You know what? We need to put something in perspective right at the start of our session. In today's times, when we are all aware more than ever of animal protection and conservation, a book that seems to celebrate a colonial shikari might strike some readers as being somewhat tone deaf. Let's face it, shikari is a word that today carries much negative connotation. But let's also face another fact. This book is a recounting of a time that was, the account of a fascinating life lived almost a decade ago. And of course, some of the ways in which Don Anderson lived that life might not pass the filter of political or environmental correctness now. However, you can't wish that time or the people who lived in that time away. What is your take on this, Joshua?
While the title of the book certainly may allude to the contents being that of a hunting chronicle of sorts, I would just like to state that the book does not celebrate shikar or hunting in any form or manner. The way I would describe it is an attempt, or maybe I could even say a tribute, to a very specific way of life in Bangalore. and ranging all the way from the 30s to the 2000s, through the eyes of someone who experienced both ends of that spectrum of or the time frame. And I don't think there are too many books written on people whose lives straddle both colonial and modern day Bangalore, or maybe even India for that matter. And I thought it would make it an interesting read. I had to encapsulate this incredible story in some form or shape and share it. The reason is we often tend to forget that people and places like this even existed, right? Memories are very short. And another reason was, I think maybe from my own personal experience, when someone from an older generation passes away, people say, you know, what a great life they led. Why didn't someone just capture that or document all of that? Well, I didn't want to be that someone in this case. So I thought I just had to put it together. I think you mentioned political correctness towards the end of your question. I must admit that the protagonist of my book was completely oblivious to what that meant. That certainly didn't exist when he was growing up. And although the world around him changed and changed for the better, he certainly didn't realize it. And that's why it's written with that specific tone and manner. Now, without a care in the world, Donald lived a fairly self-centered life for 80 years. And that's one of the reasons I found him to be so interesting. He never did anything in half measure. He may have had regrets, but I don't think he was really apologetic about the way he lived his life. No, that wasn't Donald Anderson at all.
Okay, just allow me to harp on the same subject once again. Let's face it, a book on a shikari with a provocative title to boot. I'm curious. Was it hard to find a publisher to take on this work?
Right from the start, I was fully aware that my book was never going to be one of those, you know, just waiting to be discovered and to become a sensation. I knew the limited appeal it would have because it only appeals to a certain kind of audience. So I really thought of this as a left brain exercise. And I know that's not how most authors would approach a book. And the creative side of yours, Sheila, as an author yourself, you must be shocked that I did it in this manner. But however, I knew that when I approached a publisher, I had to actually sell it as a business proposal, not as a labor of love. I had to sell a concept that translated into maximum sales for them with the least effort for the publisher. So let me tell you what that meant. So as I was writing this book, I was also building an extensive plan, and I had 6 years to do this. So 6 years I spent writing the book, and in parallel, I was building this mega Microsoft Excel heavy plan. That a plan that listed how I would find buyers, which media houses I would approach, which journalists in those media houses I would reach out to write reviews, pick people in academia, bloggers, institutions, a Facebook group with audiences built over time who are primed and ready for when the book came out. Conservationists, influencers, my friends and family, Donald's friends, and yes, even a certain politician with a large following on social media. I had all this, you know, put into this huge file, color-coded, sorted, filtered with updates and to-dos. And that's what I really used to convince publishers, saying, you know what, I'll do all the hard work. You just focus on the publishing.
That's quite a win-win offer, really. But Joshua, Matthew, that is a lot of prep. Did everything go according to plan?
Even the best laid plans never do, do they? But I just kept at it, and the responses varied from no response to, sorry, we're not interested, to great story, but I believe we couldn't do justice to it. All sides of responses I got. And I practically wrote to every Indian publishing house and a host of literary agents, both in India and in the UK. I, in fact, even went as pinpointed as contacting publishers in Edinburgh. That's where the Andersons came from. And even the Scottish High Commission saying that, listen, this is a story of one of you. Why don't you pick up this book?
And what was the kind of responses?
It varied. And I'll just explain a little more detail about how I did this. So while writing to the UK group of audience, right, publishers or literary agents, I think it was pretty standard saying, here is one of your sons who came to India and led his life and things like that. But when I wrote to publishing houses in India, I would never send a proposal to a generic website ID. I would try and find an individual, preferably somebody really senior or someone who had some connect, ask someone to connect me to them, write to their personal IDs. And these would be very well researched about how my book made sense for that publishing house, either referring to titles that they published in the past or some thread that hope would catch their attention. It was never saying, here is a manuscript. I just felt that the negative publicity that could have come with this book and a title like this is what really scared people. A lot of people and publishers even said, listen, great, but why don't you try self-publishing? But I was just so vain and headstrong and stubborn, and I was adamant that I would one day find someone who would recognize it for what it stood for, and it happened one day.
You were under no pressure where timeline was concerned, is it?
Not really.
I mean, even a self-imposed timeline.
I won't admit it, but I've exceeded that timeline by years. But you know what? It takes what it takes. And in 7 years, I think I managed to bring it out.
Well, Joshua, I know who I have to turn to when it comes to marketing of my next book. I am impressed, honestly. Okay, so the blurbs on the book jacket contain traits from leading conservationists like Sri T.N.A. Perumal, Dr. Ullas Karanth. So it is clear that many readers did get the inherent spirit of the book. Sri Perumal, who is considered to be the father of Indian wildlife photography, says that both he and Don Anderson were keen naturalists, starting out with hunting, then choosing divergent paths. Don Anderson was exposed to the jungles at a very early age, so we read. Do you think that would have contributed to his decision to take up hunting? Or did the blood sport speak to something intrinsic in his nature?
So I'll start with the two people you mentioned. And I really couldn't have hope for a better endorsement than the two of them. They both come from Bangalore, and this is a Bangalore story. And by sheer coincidence, both of them knew the Anderson family. So while Sri Perumal was kind enough to write the foreword because of the friendship he had with Don, I have to admit that Dr. Karan's response to agree to write a blob was quite unexpected. I just walked in one day, told him about the book, and he said, yes, he is such a large-hearted gentleman. And the same thing happened with Ruskin Bond as well. So to counter the rejection from the multitude of publishers, there were these absolutely wonderful and I would even say unexpected moments that would happen. Now, I think both Sri Perumal and Dr. Karan said yes for different reasons. I think for Perumal, he had the highest regard for Donald as a naturalist. In fact, he would say, irrespective of whether you had a gun or a camera, once you go out into the forest, and obviously you had different expectations, right? The outcome would be very different. But he kept saying, till the last minute where you click the trigger, one on a camera and one on the gun, the rest of the experience is the same. You have to know how animals behave. You'd have to understand the environment, everything. As for Dr. Karanth, I think he's an academic, and I think he was happy that this book served as a record for the way our forests were, right? Of what we have lost today. And I think he saw it more than just a hunting memoir. And I would even say he saw it the way I envisaged the book. So both of them expressing their willingness to contribute to the book for very, very different reasons. You mentioned something about Donald's hunting.
You know, whether this blood sport spoke to something deep inside him, or was it because he, you know, used to go into the jungles as a schoolboy? What do you think?
You know what? I think there could be multiple reasons for that. The single biggest reason, I think, would be his father's influence or the way he was taken out into the forest at a very, very young age. Maybe not hunting, but that familiarity to be in the forest, to enjoy it, right? That came from his father. The second, which could be a slightly controversial element, is the social fabric in those days, the influential years where he was growing up. I think the colonial definition of what it was to be a man or to have a rite of passage also meant doing things like this, taking a gun and shooting animals, right?
Right, yes. Back in the day, yes.
Absolutely. And those were the principles in those days. The last one, I would attribute it to the absence of strict rules or regulations, right? There was no concept of conservation those days. People just did what they wanted. And knowing Donald, as I did, I know he would be far more comfortable facing a tiger unarmed rather than have anything to do with the government.
Yes, that comes through actually in the book. It does.
He had this morbid fear that one day he would get deported because he was a British citizen, and he would go to great lengths just to stay in the government good books. So if the government had been strict saying, absolutely, you cannot do this, I'm sure Donald wouldn't have. In fact, even a lot of the hunting he did was with clear government or Forest Department approvals. So he did it with a license. And yeah, I think that kind of explains one of the reasons.
Basically, a man of his times. And no getting away from that. So, well, Don Anderson comes across as a latter-day Jim Corbett of the South. Now, Corbett was Brit, But Bangalorean old-timers seem to remember Don Anderson as an Anglo-Indian swashbuckler. Can you shed some light on his actual antecedents?
Swashbuckler is the right word, Sheila. Okay. But the term Anglo-Indian, as we understand today, was not really the original definition. So initially, during the British Raj, it was a term used to describe the domiciled British in India. Then it was used to describe those who chose to stay back in India after independence. And lastly is the definition we are all comfortable with, those with mixed ancestry or what was called Eurasians in those days. So going by these definitions, Don was certainly an Anglo-Indian. So technically, I must tell you, he had a Scottish father, and on his mother's side, he had Sri Lankan, Australian, and Dutch blood. But all the members of the family, I must tell you, thought of themselves as Indians first, and very proud Indians too. But being part of the British cantonment in those days, there were certain things that were just defaulted to him. You studied in a school like Bishop Cotton's, you excelled at sports, you rode motorcycles, you had many girlfriends, most of them at the same time, and have this enormous zeal for life and not really worrying about the future.
That came through loud and clear. And you know, the times may have changed, but you can't help but tip a hat to that kind of state of mind. Don Anderson's father was the famous hunter, naturalist and writer Kenneth Anderson. Despite having grown up in considerably comfortable circumstances, Don spent his last days, sadly enough, a really poor man. Did you sense any regrets in the man for a life lived king size, maybe even recklessly?
I don't know about regrets. So his father, as you rightly described, was a huge sensation for the books he wrote. And there were monetary benefits as well. But apart from that, he had a steady job. He worked for the Telegraph Department and later HAL. So the family was definitely well off. Now, as for Don, someone who passed senior matriculation, that's the 9th standard equivalent of today, Don did fairly well for those days. He worked at Binney Mills and things like that. But I don't think he really planned to live that long to even consider savings or planning. His plan was very simple, to live a very hedonistic life filled with extravagance of every kind and die at the peak of his life. But he would tell me with a lot of regret saying, Josh, you know what? I didn't die. I just grew old. And I don't think anyone could have really foreseen the tragedy he went through, having seen people around him pass away, migrate to the UK, and not really having an income for 30 odd years, plagued with illnesses, and really living off people's kindness or even handouts. Now, from living in a mansion just off MG Road, which is on Kasturra Road, to finally living his last days in a servant's outhouse, the fall from grace was quite tragic. And the funny thing is, you would think that with all these problems, he would be amenable to some sort of compromise.
Joshua, what do you mean when you say compromise?
He wanted to stay in that particular house. He wouldn't move out. We tried to arrange things for him with a cheaper accommodation or somewhere with closer medical care or something like that. But he was adamant. He just wanted to stay there. He would not move out of the house, like I told you. He would not follow medical advice. He would be too proud to ask for help. He was this crabby old gentleman from the British Raj who refused to accept that he had to change. He lived his way the way he wanted right to the end.
Okay, so let's focus the spotlight on Bangalore now. This book is both a Bangalore book, one of the very few that talk of the city's colonial past actually, as well as one that crosses the boundaries of Bangalore, in that it details the life of, you know, a hunter in India, a man given a license by the government to rid people of the menace of marauding animals. Anderson lived from 1934 to 214, I think, right? So in Bangalore, which was then a small town, it was hedged by deep, dense jungle, thick with panther, bear, wild boar, elephant. All of it sounds really exciting and, you know, I mean, unimaginable to the Bangalore denizen of today. So at one point in your book, I really appreciated that Anderson states that he will not defend hunting animals because they were in any case treated as vermin back in the day and that hunters were rewarded for killing those animals. Then he was witness to some drastic changes in his city, in the forests that he used to frequent, a shrinking and disappearance of the animals in those forests. This was unsettling change, right? A change that happened rapidly, not really incrementally. So what interesting details did you glean about Bangalore in the 40s, 50s while writing this book?
You asked me about shrinking habitat. So I must tell you that while the edge of the forest today has moved from the city further away, the animals you've mentioned, like vermin and things like that, still exist in the periphery. I don't mean to say they're vermin, but, and this isn't just a phenomenon with Bangalore alone. As people, we've destroyed so much of their habitat, shrinking their space to almost bursting point, that man-animal conflict is inevitable. Elephants will raid farms where crops are grown. Leopards will prey on easy prey like dogs in villages that border forests. But all the way up to 1972, when the Wildlife Act was passed, a lot of these animals were considered vermin, of course, except elephants, of course. And the government and forest department would actually advertise rewards for the skins of many of these animals. And I think that's what Don meant by saying that, listen, I have the government telling me to do this, and that's why I'm doing it. Regarding the change, I may sound a little philosophical here, but as human beings, we want everything. We want progress. We want development. We want longer lifespans. We want convenience. But we want greenery. We want bird song. We want to reduce traffic congestion, but we don't want roads to be widened. I just think that we haven't found a solution that makes everyone happy. And who knows, maybe we never will. So in the 30s and 40s, right? There was no fans or fridges. Yet there was ice cream, but you had to make it at home, and there was one flavor.
Which is what? Vanilla?
Possibly. You knew everyone you met on the road, and you always said good morning with a smile. Bread, milk, eggs were delivered home. Well, but that hasn't really changed with the likes of Big Basket, etc. It's still delivered home. So that may not be the right example.
Without quite the old atmosphere, right?
Absolutely. But milk was delivered in glass bottles. Fish was delivered wrapped in newspaper. There was no concept of plastic. People like the barber came home and gave haircuts, and everybody got haircuts on the same day. During the war, you could tell time, I mean, specifically 9 p.m., because then the electricity would be switched off. If you live close to school, Don did, you either walked to school or rode a pony. If your family moved away for some reason, you still walk the 8 kilometers. You were expected to do that in a certain manner, and that's the way you did it. There was no consideration given your age or anything like that. As a boy, you swam in ponds and lakes inside the city. You scraped knees and elbows and ate what you liked and drank what you liked, and you never really fell ill. And if at all you did, castor oil was a solution for everything. If you were in Bishop Cotton Boys in the 40s, in some distant corner of the school grounds, there would be betting matches that involved fighting quails or spinning tops or kites or things like that. Those things are clearly not there in schools anymore. And I'd be shocked if they were.
Really interesting. And well, your book paints some vivid pictures of its very colorful protagonist. Why? What do I mean? I mean, Don Anderson acted as a stunt double for Stuart Granger in a Hollywood film. He drove down the MG Road of yore, a slain panther slung across the handlebars of his motorbike. He went stalking one leopard, ended up shooting three. Then he was wooing and being wooed by a bevy of Bangalore beauties. So I'm curious, when you sat down to talk to him, I think it was in 2008, Joshua?
Right, correct.
So he would have been what, 74?
Yes, he was.
So was the process of info gathering easy? I mean, as in, did he want to brag, or was it akin to pulling water out of a stone?
While there may have been a slain panther on the handlebar of his Norton motorcycle, there was also a pretty girl riding pillion. And that was not an uncommon sight on South Parade in those days. I think this reputation, and of course his build and good looks, made him perhaps the only choice in 1958, when 20th Century Fox wanted a stunt double for Stuart Granger for the film Harry Black and the Tiger. Don was the obvious choice. The reason for that is Bhowani Junction had been filmed in Pakistan a few years earlier, and the idea of film set in India suddenly were new pastures for Hollywood. And the Western idea, or maybe ignorance of what India was all about, was good enough reason for them to say, you know what, let's make more films like this in India, I suppose. Though the exact moment where Donald appears in the film is less than half a second or a split second, it did add to his fame. Another Bangalore icon I thought I'd talk about was that associated with the film was the Koshi's restaurant. They delivered food for the film crew in Bandipur from Bangalore every single day. And the earlier generation of the Koshis, which is Matthew and Uman Koshi, also studied with Donald at Bishop Cotton's Boys' School. While this book has, like you said, so many stories of Donald's hunting, yes, there are stories of Donald hunting leopards, shooting an elephant with the wrong kind of ammunition. But there are also non-hunting stories. So there are stories of him chasing a tiger completely unarmed, screaming and shouting rather than having to shoot it. Insights into the tribes that lived in these forests in different parts of South India and their habits. There's a story of how a friend of his actually flew a plane out of HAL to help Donald and his friends on a duck shoot. Cars that cost 45 rupees, which ran on kerosene. And for those interested in trivia, Donald also owned the famous motorcycle with the sidecar from Shole. But no, he did not play a stunt double in that film. He didn't pick the non-hunting stories to balance the tone of the book at all. In fact, each story held a special memory for him. And the common thread that I could really gather was his great love for the outdoors, away from the city, surrounded by elements that he was comfortable with.
So you're telling us that the balancing act was actually done by you as a writer?
It just came and I just put it all together. It wasn't intentional to have X number of hunting stories and so many of non-hunting stories. These were stories that were important to him and he had such good memories. I just put them together. So gathering these stories was not really difficult at all. And it's a shame that he wasn't around when this book got published because he would have loved all the attention with all this.
So did he die a long while before this came out in print or a short while?
So he passed away in 2014 and the book got published in 2018. So 4 years later.
Interestingly enough, Joshua, I find the mood of the book gets a bit darker in the concluding chapters. Clearly, Don Anderson's days of glory were well past him. His future looked quite shaky. So was that shading of the story instinctive or was it intentional writing?
Telling you, I just knew him for 6 of the 8 years he lived. And while during those 6 years, there were incredible moments, right? Moments and memories etched in my brain, like the time he chased a tiger on foot with just a walking stick for support. What I remember a lot are days of his strife, ailments, financial troubles, problems just seemed to plague him. And I guess that's why the last chapter has a very dark tone to it. It also probably contrasts with the earlier chapters because for the first 8 chapters, what I captured were him speaking either to me or into a dictaphone. There was a certain pride and bravado when these stories were being narrated. I guess that's why the contents of these earlier chapters seem comparatively lighter.
In fact, exhilarating, I would say, you know, not just light. I mean, it came through.
I also feel that as we age, we remember the distant past, especially childhood with such fondness, right? Because life was so simple back then. And I'm guessing life in Bangalore, pre-independence for a family like the Andersons was as uncomplicated as it could get. And Donald, in his youth, he did exactly what he wanted to do. Hunting, girlfriends, acting in a Hollywood film, becoming a champion angler. He personified a certain lifestyle back then.
I think larger than life, isn't it?
I suppose.
Can you think about it? Yeah, really. But, you know, having said that, it kind of progressively darkened, there was no doubting that it was underpinned with a deep compassion, Joshua. You know, the writing, the whole account, actually. So you did feel extremely sorry for the gentleman. When one reads of white hunters, the picture that slips into one's mind is that of someone in khakis and a solar topi ordering his jungle scouts to chase the tiger out while he delivers the coup de grace. Was Donald Anderson quite like that? I mean, you know, a stereotype, or was his jungle craft of a different type?
If I look at the photographs that he shared with me, I noticed that he was extremely well-groomed for somebody who had just shot a tiger, spent 2 days in the jungle, living in meager accommodation like thatch huts and sleeping on the floor. But I think the photograph was just an indication of his vanity at that moment when the picture was taken, because hair was neatly combed with grill cream, not one strand out of place. But it is really not reflective of his jungle craft at all. He was not one of those hunters who ordered the local to do the hard work while he squeezed the trigger. So having learned tracking at a very young age, he was a master at constructing a story with just telltale signs that most of us wouldn't even give a second glance to. So I can give you an example. And this is during one of the trips that I went with Don in the Nilgiris. So once we were walking on a mud road and we saw some hoof marks. Now, the depth of these tracks increased after a while. And Donald rightly guessed that they were made by a herd of bison that were grazing. And the reason for the change of the depth is because they had started to run after being startled by the presence of a predator. And sure enough, a bit later, as we walked, we saw the imprints of a tiger that had followed the bison herd. So just by the depth of the imprint, he could actually tell the story. And even in those days, like past 75, his eyesight was excellent. His hearing was immaculate, and he would know how animals would react at various instances. As I've mentioned, I watched him chase a tiger on foot. And on another instance, I watched him approach a large leopard that had killed a spotted deer in almost complete darkness. Now, was he smart or stupid? I don't know. And I don't think the leopard knew either. But all I know is that he came out of the incident unscathed, and I was left with some unforgettable memories.
Now I hear two translations into Malayalam and Kannada are in the offing. Am I right?
That's right, Sheila.
So what I want to ask you is something personal. What is your personal take on the way Don Anderson lived? You know, the way he culled animals, of course, with a license, the swagger he acquired, the swagger he displayed as a shikari. Do you think he was justified for all the hunting he did?
Oh, absolutely not, Sheila. One always has choices, and there could be arguments that he was a victim of circumstance and upbringing and maybe even traces of hereditary influence. But I think there was an excess in his case.
Mm. What do you mean by excess?
Excess is subjective, Sheila. What is excess for us today may not have been excess for people in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So let me give you an example. The Nilgiri Wildlife Association, an organization deep-rooted in the protection of animals, started off as a regulatory body for license hunting. So collectively, they are responsible for so much of the slaughter of the animals that happen in that area. Now, people's conception of what is acceptable and what is not always changes. And 70 years back, as I mentioned, there was no concept of conservation. I don't think it occurred to anyone that we would ever reach a day where cities would grow so large or people's greed and ambition would reduce animal habitat to the extent we see today. Perhaps it was a time of ignorance, but even for those times, I think Donald crossed a line somewhere.
I wonder if he acknowledged it even to himself, you know, in his later years.
We'll never know.
So Joshua, Matthew, it was a pleasure to read your book, and it has been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you so much.
Joshua, Sheila, thank you so much for joining us. And this was a wonderful conversation, and I can't wait to read the book myself. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pavan.
Thank you, Pavan.
Thank you for listening in till the end. Please share this episode with a friend on social media, WhatsApp, or anywhere else. It would mean the world to us. And in case you're listening via iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. Subscribe to BIC Talks on email or your favorite podcast app, and don't miss out on future episodes. This episode of BIC Talks has Gaurav Krishna as our sound engineer, with support from S. Sarvanaraj and Lekha Naidu. And the accompanying episode artwork was made by Chandni Venkataraman.
Thank you for listening to this episode of BIC Talks. This podcast can be accessed on our website, bangaloreinternationalcenter.org, as well as on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Tune in for new episodes every week, and do subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages to stay informed on our latest updates.